Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode. I'm Nova.
And I'm Aloy. Good to be here.
So Aloy, I've got a question for you. Have you ever tried to run a 72 billion parameter model on your laptop?
Laughs, oh god, no. I'd probably watch my fan spin up like a jet engine and then listen to my MacBook beg for mercy. The thing would thermal throttle so fast you wouldn't even get through the first token.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're talking about a model that needs somewhere around 150 gigabytes of VRAM to run properly. That's more memory than most people's entire computers have, let alone a laptop that you might take to a coffee shop.
And even if you had a beefy desktop with a serious GPU, you're still looking at maybe 8 GPUs just to get decent inference times. We're talking thousands and thousands of dollars in hardware. Like, you could buy a used car for what that would cost.
Right. So here's where things get interesting. What if I told you that you could take two of those beautiful Mac Studios sitting on your desk, the ones with the M3 Ultra chips, and actually run a 72B model across both of them? Split the layers between the machines, distribute the computational load, and get something actually usable.
That sounds like magic. And also probably incredibly complicated. Like, I'm imagining cables everywhere and some kind of Rube Goldberg machine of software.
It sounds like magic, but it's actually a real thing, and it's called Exolabs. And today, we're going to dig into everything you need to know about building your own distributed AI cluster using Apple Silicon. This is going to be a deep one, so buckle up.
I'm ready. But wait, why does this even matter right now? I mean, we've been dealing with single machine inference for years. We've made peace with the limitations. What's driving this push toward distributed setups all of a sudden?
Great question. And the answer is really simple. Models keep getting bigger, but hardware has hard limits. I mean, look at where we were even 2 years ago. Models were measured in billions of parameters, and now we're casually talking about 70, 80, even 100 billion parameter models. It's just been this relentless march toward bigger and better. And hardware hasn't kept pace at the same rate.
The M3 Ultra in a Mac Studio maxes out at 192 gigabytes of unified memory. That's a lot, but it's not 150 gigabytes for a single model plus overhead a lot. You start adding in the KV cache, the activations, the attention computations, and suddenly that 192 gigabytes doesn't feel so unlimited anymore.
Exactly. You think you've got headroom, and then you actually try to run one of these models and realize you're swapping to disk and your inference speed drops to like one token per minute. It's painful.
And the thing is, we keep wanting to run bigger and bigger models. Like, I want to run Qwen 72B. I want to run DeepSeek 70B. I want to run all these amazing models that people are releasing. But on a single machine, it's just not practical. The inference is painfully slow, if it even loads at all.
Exactly. So distributed inference, spreading the model across multiple machines, that's the way forward. And Exolabs is the project that's making that actually possible on Apple Silicon, in a relatively accessible way. It's peer-to-peer, it's designed specifically for our Macs, and it's open source.
I mean, this is the kind of thing that used to require a data center. You'd need NVLink clusters and specialized networking and a whole team to set it up. Now we're talking about doing it with consumer Mac hardware in your home office.
That's the revolution here. Democratization. Making distributed inference accessible to regular developers and researchers who don't have access to enterprise clusters.
Okay, so I need to know more. What exactly is Exolabs? How does it work? And is it actually ready for prime time, or is it one of those projects that sounds great but falls apart in practice?
That's what we're here to talk about. Let's dive in. #segment 2, what is Exolabs? So Aloy, let's get into the nuts and bolts. What is Exolabs, exactly?
From what I understand, it's an open source project over at GitHub. github.com/exo-explore/exo. It's specifically designed for distributed inference on Apple Silicon hardware.
That's right. It's an open source project, and here's the important part, it's actively maintained. As of February 25, 2026, they're at version 1.0.68. That's recent. We're recording this in early 2026, and the project is clearly being actively developed. That's a good sign.
Absolutely. There's nothing worse than finding a cool open source project and then realizing it was last updated 3 years ago and everyone's moved on. You feel like an archaeologist digging up something dead.
The commit history looks healthy, the issues are being responded to, and new versions are dropping regularly. That's exactly what you want to see.
So how does it actually work? Like, I understand the concept of distributed inference in theory, but what's happening under the hood?
The core idea is that Exolabs shards model layers across multiple machines. So instead of trying to fit the entire 72B model onto one Mac, you split the layers. Machine 1 handles layers 1 through 36, machine 2 handles layers 37 through 72, and they communicate with each other during inference.
So it's not replicating the whole model on each machine. It's literally cutting it in pieces and distributing the pieces.
Exactly. Each machine is responsible for a contiguous range of layers. When you prompt the model, the input goes to the first machine, which processes its layers and passes the output to the second machine, which processes its layers, and so on. It's like an assembly line.
That makes sense. It's kind of like how distributed training works, but for inference specifically. You're pipelining the computation.
Exactly. And it leverages MLX Distributed, which is Apple's machine learning framework for Apple Silicon. MLX itself is already incredibly optimized for the M-series chips. Apple's done amazing work there, and the distributed version lets you spread computations across multiple machines. Exolabs sits on top of that and handles all the coordination.
So it's building on top of Apple's own tools. That's smart. They're not reinventing the wheel, they're using the infrastructure that Apple already provides and adding the distributed orchestration on top.
And Apple has been investing heavily in MLX and making it more capable. So Exolabs benefits from all of that work. It's a virtuous cycle.
Okay, so we know it shards layers and uses MLX distributed. But what kind of performance are we actually talking about here? Is it worth the hassle?
The results are pretty compelling. According to their benchmarks, you can get roughly 1.8 times the speed up with just two nodes. So instead of waiting forever for your 72B model to generate a response, you're getting close to double the throughput. That's the difference between something being usable and something being painfully slow.
1.8x with two machines. That's not linear scaling, but it's still a massive improvement. And the more machines you add, the better it should get, right?
In theory, yes. Though there are practical limits around network latency and the overhead of transferring activations between machines. But for 2 to 4 nodes, which is what most people would realistically set up, the speedup is significant. And as the software improves and we get better networking options, those numbers will only get better.
What about the models themselves? Like, what can you actually run? Is it limited to certain model architectures?
Good question. Exolabs works with any model that MLX supports, which is a growing list. We're talking about the Llama family, Qwen, Mistral, DeepSeek, all the major open weight models that people actually want to use.
That's a solid selection. The big players are all there.
And the other piece that's really nice is the peer discovery. I know we touched on this briefly earlier, but let's go deeper.
Yeah, because that's always the pain point with these kinds of setups. How do the machines even find each other? Like, do I need to manually configure IP addresses and set up a network and all that jazz?
That's the beautiful part, no. Exolabs uses MDNS for peer discovery. MDNS is multicast DNS, and what that means in practical terms is that if your machines are on the same local network, they find each other automatically. You don't need to mess with IP addresses or network configuration. It's genuinely plug and play.
That is genuinely impressive. So I could have 2 Mac Studios in my office, both on my Wi-Fi network, and Exolabs would just find them? Connect them? Start distributing inference?
Essentially, yes. The whole discovery process is automatic. Both machines run the Exolabs process, they broadcast their presence via MDNS, they see each other, and they form a cluster. It's that simple.
That's wild. I remember setting up Hadoop clusters back in the day, and it was a nightmare. You had to edit configuration files and worry about SSH keys and all this stuff.
This is definitely a different era. Now, for the best performance, you definitely want a wired connection. We're talking Thunderbolt direct connections for the fastest internode communication. But for getting started, MDNS discovery on a local network works out of the box.
So I could literally try this over Wi-Fi first, see it work, and then upgrade to a wired setup for performance.
Exactly. That's a great way to get started. Run it over Wi-Fi, verify everything works, and then invest in the Thunderbolt cables and direct connections for the real deal.
Okay, so this is sounding more and more accessible. But I know there are different ways to run Exolabs. There's the app, and there's running from source. What's the difference? Which one should I use?
That's a really important distinction, and it's where things get nuanced. Let's talk about that. Segment 3, source versus exo.app.
So there are two ways to run Exolabs. There's the app, and there's running from source. I'm guessing the app is the easier option? Like, download and go?
The app is definitely simpler. You download it, you install it, you open it, and everything just works. There's a GUI, you click some buttons, and you're off to the races. For someone who just wants to try it out and see what distributed inference looks like, the app is perfect. It's the low-friction entry point.
And the downside is?
The downside is transparency and control. When you run the app, the logs are hidden. You can't easily see what's going on under the hood. There are no recovery scripts built in. And the app requires a GUI. If you're running headless servers, you're out of luck.
That makes sense. If something goes wrong, you need to be able to see what's happening. Hidden logs are a deal-breaker for anything beyond casual experimentation.
Absolutely. And that's where running from source comes in. You clone the repository, gitclonegithub.com/exo-explore/exo, and then you run it with uvrunexo. That gives you full visibility into everything that's happening.
And I assume there are other benefits to running from source beyond just seeing the logs.
There's one critical advantage that I want to highlight: access to the RDMA recovery script. If you're using RDMA for your internode communication, and we'll get into what RDMA is in the next segment, sometimes things go wrong. Connections drop, and you need a way to recover. The script at tmpset_rudmer_network_config.sher is your lifeline there.
RDMA. That's the thing that bypasses the CPU for memory transfers, right?
We'll get to that in detail in the next segment. But yes, exactly. And the point is, that recovery script is only available when you run from source. The app version doesn't expose it. You can't access it through the GUI.
So if something goes wrong with RDMA and you're on the app, you're just stuck?
Essentially, yes. You'd have to fall back to the source version to debug and recover. So from the start, if you know you're going to use RDMA, just start with source.
Okay, so for casual use, the app is fine. But for anything serious, anything where reliability matters, source is the way to go.
Exactly. And here's another detail. In version 1.0.68, they added logs at tilde.exo/exo_logs. So when you're running from source, you can actually see what's happening. You can debug issues. You can monitor performance. That's huge for troubleshooting.
And I imagine if you're building a distributed cluster that's supposed to run reliably, you want all that visibility. You're not going to ship production workloads with a black box.
100%. If you're setting this up in a production environment or even just for serious experimentation, running from source is the move. The app is great for getting your feet wet, but for any reliability-focused setup, you want full control.
I also imagine the source version lets you stay on the cutting edge. Like, when new features come out, you can pull them immediately rather than waiting for an app update.
That's a good point. And since the project is actively maintained with frequent releases, being on source means you get access to the latest fixes and features as soon as they're available.
Got it. App for quick testing, source for real work. That's a clean breakdown.
Now, let's talk about the gnarly stuff. The part where things can actually go wrong. Because ExoLabs is impressive, but it's not magic. There's some real complexity underneath, especially when it comes to RDMA. And that's where a lot of people get tripped up. Segment 4 RDMA Deep Dive.
Okay, so RDMA. I've heard the term, but can we start from the basics? What exactly is RDMA and why should I care?
RDMA stands for Remote Direct Memory Access. And what it does is pretty remarkable. Normally, when two computers communicate over a network, the data has to go through the CPU. The CPU has to read the data from memory, send it out over the network, and then the receiving CPU has to process it. It's fine for most use cases, but when you're transferring large amounts of data repeatedly, like you do in distributed inference, that CPU overhead adds up.
So it's like having to go through the bottleneck of the CPU every time you want to move data between machines.
Exactly. And that bottleneck becomes a real problem when you're trying to move gigabytes of activation data per second.
So RDMA bypasses that?
Precisely. RDMA lets the network card directly read from and write to memory, without involving the CPU at all. That means dramatically lower latency and dramatically higher throughput. For our use case, where we're constantly passing activations and layer outputs between machines, RDMA is a game changer.
That sounds amazing. It's like having a direct pipeline between the two machines' memory. No CPU in the middle slowing things down.
That's exactly what it is. It's a direct memory channel. And for distributed inference, that directness is crucial. Every microsecond matters when you're pipelining between nodes.
But I assume there's a catch?
There are catches. Several of them. First, you need the right hardware. For Mac Studios, you need Thunderbolt 5 cables. Not Thunderbolt 4. TB4 won't work for RDMA on Mac Studio. You need TB5.
Okay, so TB5 cables. That means the newer cables, the ones that came out more recently. Got it. I can't just grab the Thunderbolt cable I already have sitting in my drawer.
You might be able to, but it won't work for RDMA. And there's a specific reason for this. Thunderbolt 5 has higher bandwidth and lower latency than Thunderbolt 4, which matters for RDMA. The technology simply isn't supported on TB4.
That's good to know. It's one of those things where you'd waste hours troubleshooting if you didn't know. Oh, this cable doesn't work even though it's a Thunderbolt cable.
Exactly. And here's a weird one. You cannot use the Thunderbolt 5 port that's adjacent to the Ethernet port on the Mac Studio. For some reason, that specific port doesn't support RDMA. You have to use the other TB5 ports.
That's a very specific gotcha. I can already imagine someone spending hours troubleshooting because they plugged into the wrong port. It's like when Apple changed the iPhone port and suddenly your old accessories didn't work.
It'll be in the documentation eventually, but yeah, that's the kind of thing that trips people up. You really need to pay attention to which port you're using.
Okay, so TB5 cables and the right ports. What else?
Now, here's the big one. The number one cause of RDMA failures, macOS versions must match exactly across both machines.
Exactly? Like, to the patch level?
Exactly. If one machine is running macOS 15.2 and the other is running 15.3, RDMA will fail. Not might fail, will fail. The versions have to be identical.
That's brutal. I mean, most people don't even think about that. You update your computer and forget about it, and suddenly your cluster stops working. It's like when you update your phone and your accessories don't pair anymore.
And it's not just about being careful, it's about being deliberate. You need to make sure both machines are on the exact same macOS version before you start your ExoLabs cluster. Once you have it working, you probably want to delay updates until you've tested compatibility.
That's a real operational constraint. It's not a set it and forget it thing. You have to be intentional about your system management.
You do. And that might be a deal breaker for some people. But if you want the performance, that's the price of admission.
Okay, so matching macOS versions is critical. What else can go wrong?
There are several known failure modes. GPU lock from MLX_metal_fast_synch. This is an environment variable that can cause issues when both machines are trying to synchronize their GPUs. Sometimes nodes get stuck in a loading state, which means they're waiting for other nodes to connect, but something went wrong in the handshake. And the Thunderbolt bridge, which is what handles the direct connection between machines, can cycle on and off unexpectedly.
That sounds frustrating. It feels like there are a lot of points of failure.
There are. This is cutting-edge stuff. It's not as battle-tested as running inference on a single machine. You're introducing a lot of new variables.
And I assume there's no magic auto-recovery for these issues? Like, if something goes wrong, the software just figures it out?
Right now, no. If your RDMA connection drops, you need manual intervention. You have to restart the cluster, check your cables, verify your macOS versions, and try again. There's no built-in auto-recovery mechanism.
So this is definitely not a set-it-and-forget-it situation. You need to be prepared to debug when things go wrong.
Absolutely. You need to be comfortable troubleshooting network issues, checking logs, and doing some manual recovery. This isn't for someone who wants something that just works out of the box without any maintenance.
That's fair. You want the performance, you need to put in the work.
But here's the good news. The Exolabs team has been actively fixing these issues. Let's look at the recent version history. Version 1.0.64 introduced IP-less RDMA discovery, which was a huge improvement. Version 1.0.66 fixed the loading state issue. Nodes were getting stuck and couldn't recover, and that was addressed. And version 1.0.68, the current version, addressed the GPU lock issue.
So they're actively maintaining it and fixing the bugs as people encounter them. That's reassuring. It means the project is responsive to user feedback.
They're moving fast. Version 1.0.68 came out on February 25, 2026, so this is very recent development. The project is alive and improving. But you need to go in with your eyes open. This is cutting-edge technology. It works, it's impressive, but it's not as polished as a mainstream tool that has been around for years.
Understood. So the takeaway here is, RDMA gives you the performance you need for distributed inference, but it requires specific hardware, exact software matching, and manual troubleshooting when things go wrong.
That's the right way to frame it. And honestly, for many users, just starting with a basic network setup and skipping RDMA might be the better move initially. Get everything working, verify your cluster is stable, and then upgrade to RDMA once you have a baseline.
Smart approach. Don't bite off more than you can chew. Get the basic setup working first, then add the advanced features once you understand the system.
Exactly. All right, so that's the first half of our deep dive on Exolabs. We've covered why distributed inference matters, what Exolabs is and how it works, the differences between the app and source, and the nitty-gritty of RDMA.
And in the second half, we're going to get into the practical stuff. How do you actually set this up? What does the configuration look like? What models can you run? And we'll share some real-world experiences and tips from people who built these clusters.
Exactly. So if you're thinking about building your own distributed AI cluster, stay tuned. There's a lot more to come. Catch you next time. #Building a distributed AI cluster with Exolabs, Part 2. #Segment 5, Model Selection Guide. Okay, so we've got an Exo installed, we've got our machines talking to each other, we built a Thunderbolt bridge. Now the question everyone actually cares about, what models can we actually run on this thing? Like, I have two powerful Macs sitting here, I want to use them. What can I actually throw at this cluster?
Right. And this is where the math gets really important. You can't just grab any model and expect it to work. There's actual memory arithmetic involved, and honestly, this is something that trips up a lot of people who are new to running LLMs locally.
Let's break it down for the folks at home. Your setup is an M3 Ultra with 96GB and an M4 Max with 64GB. That's 160GB of unified memory total when you combine them. But here's the critical constraint that we've learned the hard way through testing. Models requiring over about 100GB total have been unstable. The connection between the machines starts to choke, you get weird inference glitches, and honestly it just becomes a massive headache.
Yeah, we hit that wall early in our testing. You'd think more is always better, right? More memory, more everything. But there's a tipping point where the overhead of coordinating between two machines actually starts to hurt more than it helps. So we're recommending staying under 100GB total for rock-solid reliability. Let me give you a concrete example. A 70 billion parameter model at full 16-bit precision needs about 140GB. Why? Well, each parameter is stored as a 16-bit floating point number, which is 2 bytes. So 70 billion parameters times 2 bytes equals 140 billion bytes, which is about 140GB. Simple multiplication.
And then if you quantize down to 8-bit, that's 1 byte per parameter, so that same 70 billion parameter model only needs about 70GB. Cut it in half. And at 4-bit, which is what a lot of people use for running larger models on limited hardware, you're looking at just 0.5 bytes per parameter, so about 35GB for that same 70 billion parameter model.
So with that framework in mind, let's talk about the single machine sweet spots. These are models that fit entirely on your M3 Ultra alone, no cluster needed. You could literally just run these on one machine and still have memory left over for other things.
First up, Qwen 2.5:72B at 4-bit quantization. That's about 40GB. Your M3 Ultra handles that with room to spare. You've got almost 60GB of memory left for context, for the running application, for everything else your Mac needs to do. This is a great daily driver.
Same model at 8-bit, that's about 72GB. Still fits on the M3 Ultra alone, comfortably. You get better quality output since you've got more precision in your weights, more numerical resolution, but you're using more memory. It's a trade-off, and honestly, for most tasks, 4-bit is perfectly fine.
DeepSeek R1 at 32B with 8-bit quantization is around 20GB. That's a fast reasoning model, really snappy, great if you need quick thinking without waiting around. The 32B size is interesting because it's small enough to run fast but still smart enough to be useful. It's that middle ground that a lot of people overlook.
And Llama 3.370B at 4-bit is about 40GB. This is your general-purpose workhorse. Really versatile, good for all kinds of tasks, and fits comfortably on a single machine. If you're not sure what to run, this is a safe bet. Llama has been around forever, the community support is huge, and it just works.
Now here's where distributed EXO actually starts to shine. This is cluster territory. These are models that need both machines to run, that would choke on a single Mac, but become viable when you combine that 160GB of unified memory.
Take Qwen 2.5:72B at full 16-bit precision. That's about 144GB. No way that fits on a single machine, period. Even your big M3 Ultra maxes out at 96GB. But with your 160GB cluster? You can actually run this. It's the kind of model that just wasn't possible on consumer hardware before. Server-grade AI on your desk. That's wild when you think about it.
Another interesting one is Qwen 3-235B Mo at 4-bit. That's around 120GB. Now, Mo stands for Mixture of Experts, and these models are really efficient because they only activate subsets of parameters for each token. It's not actually loading 235 billion parameters into memory, it's loading the active experts, which is much smaller. That's the magic of Mo architecture. It's worth trying across your cluster. And if anyone has the hardware to try this, we're really curious how it performs.
The sweet spot for your specific setup is models in that 80 to 140 GB range. They need both machines to run, they benefit from the distributed inference, but they don't exceed your 160 GB total. That's where you get the real benefit of running EXO across your cluster. You're not just splitting the work arbitrarily, you're actually enabling capabilities that neither machine could do alone.
And now let's talk about what to avoid. This is important, because we see people try this all the time and then wonder why their cluster keeps crashing.
DeepSeek R1671B at any useful quantization is just too large. Period. End of story. You're not running this on your cluster. Even with aggressive quantization, you're looking at hundreds of gigabytes. There's a version that people try to run at like 2-bit or something, but it's basically unusable. The model quality degrades so much that you're not getting anything useful out of it. It's better to pick a smaller model that runs well than to try to force a massive model that barely functions.
Non-MoE models over 100B parameters are also going to give you trouble. The memory requirements spiral out of control, and the connection overhead between your two machines becomes a bottleneck rather than a benefit. You're adding latency without getting any throughput improvement. It's like trying to coordinate two people to move a feather, the coordination costs more than the actual work.
The takeaway here is simple, know your math. Parameter count times bytes per parameter. It's not complicated, and it'll save you a lot of frustration. Don't guess. Don't assume. Calculate it, and then pick a model that fits.
Pick the right model for your hardware, and EXO will sing. Push too hard, and you'll be debugging connection issues at midnight. We've all been there. Well, maybe not all of us, but definitely me. Don't be me. Segment 6, Watchdog and Demonizing.
So let's talk about running this thing headless. Because if you're serious about using EXO as an actual tool, as something that sits in the background and does work for you, you're not going to want to keep a terminal window open all the time. That's not a workflow. That's a hobby.
Right. You want it running in the background, automatically, surviving restarts, that kind of thing. You want EXO to just be there when you need it, like a server, like infrastructure. But here's the thing, EXO has no built-in service manager. That's a gap in the current design.
Yeah, it's one of those things that works fine for development, works fine when you're actively hacking on it and running it from a terminal, but becomes important when you want production reliability. So you've got to handle it yourself. This is developer life.
The naive approach is the NoHub command. You've probably seen this before, maybe in some old blog post or sysadmin guide. You run nohup uv run exo tilde dot exo exo dot log 2 and 1 and it backgrounds the process. The nohup keeps it alive if you disconnect from the SSH session or close the terminal, the ampersand runs it in the background, and you're redirecting output to a log file.
That works, technically. But it's not great. If the process crashes, it's just dead. Nobody's watching. Nobody cares. You might not even know it's down until you try to use EXO and nothing happens. It's the classic set it and forget it approach, except sometimes it just forgets to work.
The better approach on macOS is LaunchTool. This is the system-level service management that Apple has had forever. You create a plist file, basically a configuration file, that tells the system how to run EXO, and more importantly, you can configure it to auto-restart on failure. If EXO dies, LaunchTool catches it and brings it back up automatically.
This is the way if you want reliability. Your LaunchTool plist can specify keep alive policies, restart intervals, all that good stuff. You can say, if this process exits for any reason, restart it immediately or wait 10 seconds and then restart. You can control the environment variables, the working directory, all of it.
There's one environment variable you absolutely need to know about. exo_libp2p_namespace. Set this to your cluster name, something like exocluster NYC or myhomara cluster or whatever makes sense for you. This is critical.
Why does this matter? Because EXO uses lib2p for networking, which is a peer-to-peer protocol. By default, everyone on the same network might see each other. It's like if you had a party and didn't assign people to specific rooms, everyone would mingle and it would be chaos. You don't want your cluster accidentally meshing with some random EXO user on your local network, sharing models and inference requests with a stranger. Namespace it. Keep your cluster isolated.
Also, log rotation. This was added in version 1.0.68, and it's one of those features that you don't appreciate until you've been burned by the alternative. Before that, your log files could grow without bound until you ran out of disk space. Imagine waking up one day and your Mac won't boot because some log file ate your entire hard drive. It happens. Now EXO handles rotation automatically. You set a max size or a max age, and it cycles through logs. Huge quality of life improvement.
Here's the recovery workflow you want, the golden path for headless operation. RDMA connection drops, and they will drop. That's just the nature of Thunderbolt networking sometimes, especially if you're moving the machines or there's electrical interference or who knows what. Launchtool detects that EXO has crashed or stopped. It restarts EXO automatically. Then you run your set_rdma_network_config.sh script, which reestablishes the Thunderbolt bridge. And your cluster reconnects.
The whole thing should be automatic if you've set it up right. You wake up in the morning, your cluster is still running, everybody's happy, tokens are flowing. It's beautiful. It's what infrastructure should feel like.
It takes some initial setup, some reading, some figuring out, but once it's done, it's done. You forget about it until something breaks, and then it fixes itself. That's the dream, right? #segment7, honest verdict.
All right, let's get real. We've spent a lot of time talking about how to set this up, the math, the configurations, the reliability engineering. But what's the actual verdict? Is EXO worth it? Should people actually do this?
EXO is genuinely exciting. I want to be clear about that from the start. The idea of running inference across multiple machines, distributing the load, doing things that used to require serious server hardware in your home office, that's genuinely exciting. It's the kind of technology that makes you feel like you're living in the future. But it's still maturing. Connection reliability is the number one pain point. We've mentioned Thunderbolt cable quality, we've mentioned the namespace isolation, we've mentioned watchdog setups. All of that exists because the connection handling still has rough edges. It's not polished. It's not turnkey. It's not something you can just install and ignore.
They're working on it. The team is actively addressing these issues. This isn't an abandoned project. People are contributing, issues are being filed, pull requests are being merged. But if you're going into this expecting a polished, turnkey experience like you'd get from a commercial product, you're going to be disappointed. This is open source. This is early stage technology. You have to meet it where it is.
Source build plus watchdog. That's the right approach for anyone serious about headless reliability. Don't rely on pre-built binaries if you can avoid it. Build from source, know what version you're running, and have your watchdog processes in place. It's more work, but it gives you control and visibility that you just don't get with pre-built packages.
And seriously, don't cheap out on your Thunderbolt cable. This is not the place to save $20. Get a good quality TB5 cable from a reputable brand. The cheap ones introduce latency and instability, and you'll be chasing problems that are really just bad hardware. We cannot stress this enough. The cable is the foundation of your cluster. Don't build your house on sand.
When it works, the speed up is real. We're not talking about marginal improvements, like maybe 5% faster. You can actually feel the difference between running a model on one machine versus distributed across two. The tokens come faster, the response times are lower, and honestly, the experience of watching a model run across your cluster is impressive. It's one of those things that's just cool.
It's the future. The machines are talking to each other, dividing the work, producing results faster than either one could alone. You're running a distributed system in your home. That's genuinely incredible when you stop and think about it.
Here's my timeline recommendation. If you want the best shot at a stable cluster, get a new Thunderbolt 5 cable. Don't reuse an old one, don't borrow one, buy a new one specifically for this. Keep your macOS version consistent across both machines, meaning don't upgrade one and not the other. Build from source, and set up your launch to Watchdog. That's the combination that's been most reliable in our testing.
Will it be perfect? Probably not. There will still be hiccups, there will still be moments where you need to kick things, there will still be issues that require digging into logs and debugging. But it'll be good enough that you can actually get work done. And as the software matures, it'll only get better.
My honest take, this is for enthusiasts, for early adopters, for people who want to push the envelope and see what's possible. If you just need to run some inference and you don't want to mess with any of this, use a cloud service. Pay someone else to deal with the reliability problems. But if you want to build something yourself, if you want control, if you want to understand how this works at a deeper level, EXO is incredible. You just have to meet it halfway. You have to be willing to put in some work to get the rewards. And honestly, that's what makes it satisfying.
That's fair. That's honest. We could sit here and pretend it's perfect, but it's not. But what it is exciting. And for the right person, it's exactly what they're looking for. Segment 8, sign off. Okay, let's wrap this up. We've covered a lot of ground in this second half. What's the key takeaway from everything we've talked about in segments 5 through 8?
Know your memory math. Don't push past 100 gigabytes reliably. Pick models that fit your cluster, don't try to force things that are too big. The sweet spot is 80 to 140 gigabytes. That's where your cluster shines.
Daemonize properly. Don't just no-hop it and hope for the best. Use LaunchTool, set up auto-restart, configure your namespace so you're isolated from other users on your network. Treat it like infrastructure, because that's what it is.
Get good hardware. Quality Thunderbolt cable, consistent OS versions, stable power, the works. The software can only be as reliable as the foundation it's running on. Don't skimp on the foundation.
And be patient. EXO is actively developing. The rough edges will get smoother over time. The documentation will improve. The defaults will get better. But right now, you have to be willing to put in a little work to get the rewards. That's the deal. That's the bargain.
To everyone who stuck with us through both parts of this series, thank you. We covered installation, networking, Thunderbolt bridging, model selection, memory optimization, reliability engineering, daemonization. That's a lot of ground. Hopefully it was useful.
It really is a lot. And if you build this cluster, if you get it running, if you watch those tokens flow between your machines, remember what you're doing. You're running a distributed AI cluster in your home. That's genuinely incredible. That's something that would have required a server room 5 years ago.
The machines are talking to each other now. That's a great point. People forget about the context. They think, oh, this model is 40 gigabytes, and they load it up, but then they paste in a huge document or a long conversation history, and suddenly they're swapping to disk and everything slows down. The actual memory usage is model weights plus KV cache for your context. Don't forget that.
Also, different model architectures have different memory footprints beyond just the parameter count. Some models use more memory for attention computations. Some have more overhead in their implementation. The math we talked about is a good starting point, but always test. Always run the model and watch your memory usage before you commit to it as a daily driver.
Test in production. Or at least, test extensively in staging. Your staging being your local machines, I guess. But you get the point.
Another thing about the daemonization. One more tip. Watch your system logs. Not just the EXO logs, but the system logs too. Sometimes the issue isn't EXO itself, it's something at the OS level. Network configuration changes, power management issues, thermal throttling. All of those can affect your cluster stability. The more visibility you have, the easier it is to diagnose problems.
And finally, engage with the community. The EXO Discord is pretty active, the GitHub issues are monitored. If you hit a weird problem, chances are someone else has hit it too. Don't suffer in silence. Ask questions, file issues, contribute back if you can. This is how open source gets better. This is how we all benefit.
That's the spirit. That's what makes this whole thing worthwhile. We're all building together. We're all figuring this out together. And that's really cool.
Bye. You know what? One last thought before we really end. This whole project, building a distributed AI cluster at home, it's not just about the technical achievement. It's about ownership. It's about having control over your own compute, your own models, your own data. You're not sending prompts to some not relying cloud API. You're on someone else's infrastructure. It's yours.
That's huge. That's genuinely huge. In a world where more and more of our computing moves to the cloud, being able to run sophisticated AI models locally, on your own hardware, is a form of digital autonomy. It's powerful. And it's something worth pursuing, even if it's harder than just using an API.
And the beauty is, it's only going to get easier. Hardware keeps getting better, software keeps getting more refined, the community keeps growing. What feels like a hobby project today might be commonplace tomorrow. You're not just building a cluster, you're building familiarity with a technology that's going to be everywhere in a few years.
Exactly. You're future-proofing yourself. You're learning the skills, understanding the architecture, getting comfortable with the challenges. By the time this becomes mainstream, you'll already be an expert. You'll already know how everything works under the hood.
That's the way to think about it. This is an investment. An investment in knowledge, in capability, in autonomy. And honestly, it's just really fun. There's something deeply satisfying about seeing two machines work together to produce something neither could do alone. It's almost like watching something come alive.
It really is. The machines are talking to each other now, and that's not just an ending line. That's what's actually happening. You're running a distributed system. You're doing distributed computing. That's computer science at a pretty fundamental level, and you're doing it in your home. See you next time.